the headlines. Israel carries out airstrikes on the Gaza Strip for the fifth straight day, prompting Palestinian resistance groups to retaliate with rockets. Also in Palestine, Israeli troops raid a refugee camp in the West Bank, killing two Palestinians and injuring several others. And Turkey is bracing for presidential and parliamentary elections set to take place on Sunday. Welcome, everybody. A funeral procession has been held in the besieged Gaza Strip for two Palestinian resistance commanders killed in Israeli attacks. The two senior officials of the Islamic Jihad movement were martyred in airstrikes by the regime on Friday. Eight resistance commanders have been killed along with their family members since Israeli warplanes began pounding Gaza on Tuesday. Israel has continued its air raids for a fifth day, targeting different parts of Gaza City. In retaliation, Palestinian resistance groups have fired more rockets toward Israeli settlements across the Gaza fence, as well as the Israeli city of Ashkelon. Palestinians have fired nearly 1,100 missiles and rockets into Israel over the past 5 days. At least 33 Gazans have been killed and nearly 150 wounded in the regime's attacks. The occupied West Bank has witnessed another day of Israel's bloodletting of Palestinians. The regime's forces have raided a refugee camp in the city of Nablus, killing two Palestinians. Several others have also been injured, with one of them being in critical condition. The raid comes amid Israel's bombardment of the Gaza Strip. Nablus has been a flashpoint of Israeli violence in recent months, as the regime has carried out repeated raids on refugee camps there. The Israeli violence in the West Bank has claimed the lives of over 100 Palestinians since the beginning of 2023. Iran's foreign minister says the Islamic Republic has made arrangements for the official opening of its diplomatic mission and consulate in Saudi Arabia. Hossein Amir Abdullahian was speaking on the phone with his Saudi counterpart, Prince Faisal bin Farhan Al Saud. He said the recent visits by officials from the two countries show that both Tehran and Riyadh are determined to cooperate with each other. Prince Faisal, for his part, expressed hope that the cooperation between the two sides will be facilitated by sending their respective ambassadors to Tehran and Riyadh. Iran and Saudi Arabia agreed to restore ties in talks held in the Chinese capital in March. The China-brokered deal put an end to 7 years of strained ties. In this segment of the program, the leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says Israel has failed to drive a wedge between Palestinian resistance groups through its latest aggression against the Gaza Strip. Said Hassan Nasrallah says resistance groups have remained united and foiled enemy plots. He added that Israel's attacks on Gaza are also a futile attempt to cover up the regime's internal crisis and restore its deterrent power. Nasrallah further said the Lebanese resistance movement will not hesitate to support Palestinians in the face of Israel's deadly violence.
We are in constant contact with the leaders of the Palestinian factions, and we are monitoring their situation and all developments minute by minute. We are providing all possible help within certain limits. But I'd like to add that at any time, if the responsibility falls on us to make a move or more, we will not hesitate to do so, God willing.
The Hezbollah leader also denounced the international community's silence on Israeli crimes against Palestinians elsewhere. He touched upon the normalization of ties between Syria and Arab countries. Nasrallah said the rapprochement has brought positive results for the region and called on Lebanon to restore ties with Syria as soon as possible. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have activist and political commentator Laith Maarouf, who's joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Also, we have academic broadcaster and investigative researcher David Miller, who's joining us from Bristol. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Maarouf in the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Mr. Maarouf, Hezbollah's Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah believes that Israel's attacks on Gaza are a futile attempt to cover up the regime's internal crisis and to restore its deterrent power. Are the Israelis also trying to divert some attention from their internal turmoil and conflict.
Well, clearly the Israeli regime is having a crisis, internal crisis, even within the extreme right-wing coalition that Netanyahu leads. So we have, of course, Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, both of them boycotting before the beginning of these attacks on Gaza, were boycotting the cabinet meetings and the Knesset meetings. But we also know that next week there will be the flags demonstration where the Zionists invade Jerusalem and the whole city and the holy sites with their flags. And as we remember, 2 years in a row in 2021 and 2022, that led to wars. And so the Zionists were trying to prepare for this flag demonstration by attacking the resistance in Gaza before it responds to that demonstration. And, of course, change the parameters of engagement, as Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah pointed out. Since the last war, the Palestinian resistance has managed to set up a new parameter for this engagement, and that includes unity of the fields, that an attack on Jerusalem or an attack on the West Bank will lead to responses from Gaza. And today, the Zionists are trying to show that, to break that will, and to also show that they are, as we see today, they are invading many cities in the West Bank and killing civilians there, as the same time that they are killing civilians in Gaza. So they want to prove themselves that they are capable of fighting the resistance on multiple fronts. Of course, the resistance has been successful in not allowing the Zionists to change the parameters of engagement.
David Miller, the latest round of escalation was triggered by Israeli forces' assassination of a number of Islamic Jihad leaders. Hamas and Islamic Jihad resistance movement said such actions will have consequences and it will not prevent them from defending the nation. Hezbollah leader Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah believes that the Israeli killing of resistance leaders and women and children will lead to an all-out conflict. Break this down for us, please.
Well, you can see that there's a certain extent to which these actions and reactions are choreographed. And these statements from the resistance, from Hamas and from PIJ, as well as from Hezbollah, are statements of intent and statements of a signal to the Zionists what's going to happen, and they make calculations about each other on that basis. We've seen 1,100 rockets fired in the last few days, quite a large number of rockets, but we really are only in the early stages of a full conflict, so we're not at the level of a full conflict. What the Israelis are trying to do is to try and divide the resistance, to cut off the head of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and to divide them from the other factions and indeed from Hamas. Now that is a non-starter, it's a total failure, and the resistance factions are all and remain united. They coordinate on a daily basis, as Nasrallah himself said, and with, of course, Hezbollah, and indeed with the IRGC. There are clear, very close relationships there about which govern the response that the factions make to Zionist aggressions. So we're at the early stages of a conflict. It looks like it's intensifying. The last time there were barrages of rockets, indeed also from Syria in the Golan, the response of the Zionists to that was to carry out bombings, but not to kill anyone. Now they've tripped a switch now, and they've gone up a level, and they've started to kill people, selective assassinations, including the whole families of PIJ commanders and others. And so that's an indication of the pressure that Zionists are feeling from the extreme right, from the fascist elements within the government. It's not easy for the Zionists to continue to escalate because the response of the resistance, as they have repeatedly said, will be to not back down. The PIJ have said that amongst their grounds for a ceasefire is the cancellation of the Flags Day demonstration, which of course is a celebration of ethnic cleansing, where the settlers run riot in Al-Quds, calling for making chants like "May your village burn" and "Death to the Arabs" and all the usual stuff that you expect from the settlers. And that, for the government to cancel that, would be a massive defeat. So, and it'll be very difficult for them to do it, given the pressure from the fascist right. So, I think what we're seeing here is to some extent, choreography, and it's a question of about who blinks first. But the resistance are showing no signs of blinking, and are showing no signs of being defeated or divided.
Thanks a lot, gentlemen. Laith Maruf, activist and political commentator, joining us from Beirut, and David Miller, academic broadcaster and investigative researcher, joining us from Bristol. With that, it brings an end here on this edition of News Review. Elsewhere, people in Turkey are set to cast their ballots in presidential and parliamentary elections on Sunday. The elections are a litmus test for President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his ruling Justice and Development, or AK, party. 64 million people are eligible to elect 600 members of parliament and the next head of state. Around 2 million Turks living abroad already cast their votes on April 17th. Incumbent Erdogan is among four candidates approved by the country's electoral body. According to opinion polls, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, leader of the main opposition, is another frontrunner in the presidential race. Candidates held their final campaign rally on Friday to woo many of the 5 million first-time voters. A runoff is expected 2 weeks later if none of the presidential candidates crosses the 50% threshold necessary to win the race. Well, this past winter, Europe grappled with soaring energy prices amid the war in Ukraine. Now a study finds that the high costs claimed the lives of some 68,000 people. That's even more than 60,000 recorded as COVID-19 deaths. The research was carried out by the British weekly The Economist, who compared actual deaths last winter with the number expected considering mortality during the same period in previous years. Last winter, the price of domestic electricity hiked nearly 70%, while the cost of gas soared by 145%. That deterred people from properly heating their homes and raised the risk of cardiac and respiratory problems. Western countries accuse Russia of weaponizing its energy supplies following the standoff over the war in Ukraine. Moscow dismissed the claim, saying Western sanctions are to blame for the surge in prices. Well, the finance ministers of the Group of Seven developed countries, or G7, have concluded their meeting in Japan, in which they expressed concern about rising economic uncertainty. In a communique, the G7 ministers asked the world to remain vigilant amid uncertainty about the economic outlook. They, however, noted that the world's economy showed resilience in the face of high inflation caused by Russia's war in Ukraine and the COVID-19 pandemic. The grouping also set a year-end deadline for launching a new scheme to diversify global supply chains. The plan aims to provide the developing countries with financial aid and assist them in playing a bigger role in the world's financial system. The G7 statement did not mention about bank failures in the U.S. as well as a stalemate over the debt ceiling there. The U.S. Treasury has warned that a possible default on debt risks a global economic downturn. And the 12th International Innovation and Technology Exhibition has wrapped up in Tehran, Iran's biggest technology event. Had brought together technology and innovation experts from around the world to bridge the gap between innovators, investors, and traders. Hisumi Shahmadi has more.
Innovation and ecosystem under one roof. Over the past week, Innotex 2023 provided a great networking opportunity for scientists and researchers and international tech entrepreneurs, leaders, and investors. The International Innovation and Technology Exhibition is Iran's biggest annual technology event and the forerunner in the region. This year's event was even more significant as six young Muslim researchers were awarded the Cannes Scientific Prize for their achievements. The CANS, or Knowledge Application and Notion for Society, is a biannual scientific competition for Muslim researchers and scientists under the age of 45.
We have a natural product to replace the chemically used pesticides. This natural product made from the leaf of a plant.
I produce a product
mosquito control to solve a problem mosquito-borne disease such as dengue, Zika and chikungunya. This is a deadly virus in the developing country.
At the moment, I am in the process of commercializing the mRNA vaccine that I was able to develop. The good news is that the same technology can be applied to make vaccines for other infectious viral diseases.
Boosting knowledge-based companies is high on the agenda in Iran, and over the past 2 years, more than 150 research projects were commercialized, 23 of which were large-scale national mega-projects, turning Iran into a regional hub, which makes Innotex even more intriguing for tech entrepreneurs, as according to the Global Innovation Index report, Iran is considered the second most innovative country in Central and South Asia.
The number of knowledge-based companies and creative startups in Iran have grown over the past couple of years. That is why the Islamic Republic of Iran's ranking in the Global Innovation Index has improved from 60th place in 2021 to 53rd in 2022. Gizumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ideal University Student brings change in thinking and reality of the society and world. The following is part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with university students and representatives of student associations in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on April 18, 2023. The subject of freedom is one of the foundations in understanding that has been spoken about in Islam. The subject of justice is one of the most important issues in understanding. These matters need to be solved. Our young university students should think about these things. They need to work on them until they attain depth. You need to read books, read the Nahjul Balagha, ponder over the verses of the Quran when it is recited. Now, consider justice as an example. Of course, an important example of justice is the elimination of economic and social inequalities and the like. But this is not the only thing. It is one of its major features. Justice begins from our personal judgments. Justice begins with our personal actions, our words, and our judgments about other people and about work. The Holy Quran says, "And ill feeling for a people should never lead you to be unfair. Be fair." The Holy Quran, Surah 5, verse 8.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Even if we disagree with someone, if we feel an enmity towards them, or if we don't think in the same manner, we should not be cruel towards them. The most tragic thing that can happen is if an unbeliever grabs me by the collar on Judgment Day, saying, Sir, you oppressed me in such and such a place. There really is nothing more difficult than that. Or if one of God's enemies has a right on me and they grab me by the collar on Judgment Day, telling me that I have wronged them. Justice is like this. About international justice, this fight against the arrogant powers, which I keep repeating, is one of the most important examples of justice. Some people seek justice, but they don't believe that the fight against the arrogant powers, the US and Zionism, are also examples of seeking justice. But they are. This is how it is. Freedom. Freedom is very important. The most important part of the theory of freedom in Islam is freedom from this framework of matter. The materialistic viewpoint says that you were born one day, you will live for a few years, and then you will stop existing. We are all doomed to perish. They will give you some types of freedom in this material cage, such as the freedom of lust, the freedom of anger, and freedom for oppression, all kinds of freedom. But that is not freedom.
Allah, I wanna thank you. That you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a program that takes you on a journey through Africa. We cover wide-ranging current affairs in the continent and also highlight various aspects of the continent's rich history, culture, and civilization. In our program today, we are focusing on the ongoing conflict in Sudan and its regional and global implications amid concern that some Western powers and the Zionist regime are involved in fomenting deadly chaos in this African nation. The United Nations has also warned that the humanitarian crisis in Sudan is at a breaking point. So, what will it take to restore stability in Sudan? Our experts will be giving us their incisive analysis on the situation in this war-torn African country. So stay with us.
Sudan in turmoil. Hundreds of people have been killed and thousands injured in fighting between two rival generals in Sudan, the Army Chief General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, who has for years been the de facto leader of Sudan, and paramilitary rapid support forces, the RSF, Commander Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, better known as Hemeti. The fighting broke out on the 15th of April following a disagreement that had been fomenting in recent months between the army and the RSF's integration into the armed forces, a key condition of Sudan's transition agreement with political groups.
Most countries have evacuated their citizens from Sudan, and now it is the civilians in this country who have been caught in the crossfire as the two warring sides battle for control of this country. Sudanese people are now hoping that the two generals will stop fighting for power and instead provide basic needs to the people of Sudan. And to discuss the situation in Sudan, we have contacted Sami Hamdi, the international interest editor-in-chief, and Julius Mbaluto, a political analyst. Thank you, gentlemen, for your time. So let's start off with Mr. Hamdi. Can you elaborate on the real reason behind the conflict in Sudan between the country's national army and the rapid support forces?
The crux of the problem is that the Sudanese army chief Abdel Fattah Burhan announced in February that the RSF, the rapid support forces led by Hemeti, must be merged with the army. And Hemeti understands that if the RSF is merged with the army, then Hemeti's power will essentially be diminished. It's essentially about clipping his wings. That's why Hemeti has decided to launch this attempt to topple Burhan before Burhan can clip his wings. But the reason Burhan wants to clip Hemeti's wings is much more complex. The reality is that Burhan has been holding on to power despite significant pressure from the international community to hand over power to the civilian Forces for Freedom and Change. The Forces for Freedom and Change are a group of civilian parties made up of leftist, communist, and the Ummah party that was once led by former Prime Minister Sadiq al-Mahdi. And Burhan has been refusing to hand over power to them and threatening elections if he's forced to do so. The point here is that the reason the Forces for Freedom and Change want a handover of power without elections is because they believe that they will lose in any elections, that any elections will deliver the Islamists to power. And that's why in 2021, instead of handing over power, Burhan instead toppled the government of the Forces for Freedom and Change. And then when there was international pressure on him to reverse his coup, he then threatened to hold elections. And this is what caused the panic in the international community, believing that if elections were held, then the Sudanese would choose the Islamists.
Now, let's bring in Mr. Mbaluto. As we know, Sudan has been without a functioning government since October 2021, when the military dismissed Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok's transitional government. Now, did the ouster of Hamdok lead to the current state of affairs in the country?
If we remember very well, before the first military takeover happened, it just came before, just after the, you know, like the revolution across Sudan, people protesting. They wanted to see an end to the rulership of Omar Bashir. And across the country, it was people protesting just across the country. So the military came to hijack the revolution, definitely. They just came to hijack the revolution.
Kenya's president, William Ruto, has said that the situation in Sudan is evolving into a threat to regional and international peace and security. Ruto also urged both sides to extend cooperation to a regional body known as the Intergovernmental Authority on Development that is trying to mediate.
A pattern of systematic violation of established norms and principles of international humanitarian law is clearly emerging, and this situation is evolving into a threat to regional and international peace and security.
Any further escalation of the conflict in Sudan will affect the wider eastern and northern African region and indeed the rest of the world.
In terms of the regional impact, war is not such a great thing because immediately it causes displacement of communities. It causes political instability because now all these people fleeing from war, they are going to countries which are neighboring, but also those countries are also experiencing their own challenges. And therefore, it just becomes even harder for all these countries surrounding.
The Sudanese people have been in the streets to demand civilian rule and to oppose a normalization deal between the military rulers and the Israeli regime. The generals had promised a return to civilian rule, but they have apparently betrayed the people by engaging in a deadly conflict. Greed, self-enrichment, and foreign meddling are seen as reasons these generals betrayed the aspirations of the people of Sudan.
I think that the betrayal comes from an international community and civilian leftist parties that agreed to enter into a deal with the army to prevent elections and prevent the Sudanese from choosing their leaders. When Omar al-Bashir was toppled, there was an opportunity to go to elections and let the Sudanese choose leaders with a mandate in order to govern the transition period. The reason they didn't go to elections was because Washington, Abu Dhabi, and the civilian leftist parties, they believed that if they went to elections, then it would be the same result as in Tunisia when the Islamist won, the same result as in Libya when the Islamist won, the same result in Egypt when the Islamist won, the same result in these other places where the Islamists were at the forefront and the beneficiaries. So they collectively came together to say, we don't want the Sudanese to vote. In other words, the betrayal began from the very beginning of the transition period. The whole transition period is built on the premise of denying the Sudanese any right to choose their leaders because they will not choose correctly. And this is the betrayal. It's not that the generals have betrayed the Sudanese people. It's that the international community that keeps talking about democracy for Sudan betrayed the Sudanese and refused to give them democracy because they didn't believe that they would make a choice that they prefer.
The conflict in Sudan has ignited concerns of an outbreak of civil war in the fragile western region of Darfur. The militia group known as the Rapid Support Forces battling the Sudanese army is led by Mohamed Degalo from the Mahariye clan of Darfur's Rezegat tribe. Now, there is real fear that the battles between Sudan's tribal military leaders could reawaken war in the vast and largely desert region of Darfur, already scarred by a two-decades-old conflict. Now, what's your take on this?
I think there is great fears now that that the war might spread to Darfur. It's important to remember that the reason Darfur calmed down is because Omar al-Bashir, in his agreement with the Darfurians, he included them in the government, he pushed for further investment in Darfur, he promoted them, Minni al-Minnawi and Jibril Ibrahim and other of these Darfurian leaders. He succeeded in winning over them and essentially forming this sort of power-sharing arrangement or including them within the government in a way that satisfied them. What's important to highlight as well is that the Darfurians have opposed the Forces for Freedom and Change and tended to side with Burhan. In 2021, when the army chief toppled the civilian government, one of the reasons he was able to do so was because the Darfurians, who have historically been backed internationally in their fight against the Sudanese state, the Darfurians themselves were very loudly complaining that there was a preference for leftist parties that could never win any elections. So Jibril Ibrahim and Minni al-Minnawi were saying, this is an unfair transition process that is disproportionately benefiting those who don't have much popular weight in the amongst the Sudanese electorate. I think that now what we're seeing is that Hemeti believes that he is able to, if he loses this fight against the Sudanese army, then he will find some base that he can operate from Darfur.
Well, thank you for that, Mr. Hamdi. Let's now take a short break before we continue our talk on the turmoil currently being experienced in Sudan.
Sudan in turmoil.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back to Africa Today. This week we are discussing the political turmoil in Sudan amid concern of a foreign meddling in the country. Now, the current conflict in Sudan is seen by analysts as part of a long-term plan by imperialist powers to balkanize Sudan. Now, the strategic objective of this plan is to ensure that the Israeli regime's superiority through the balkanization of Western Asia and Arab states into smaller and weaker states. It is in this context that the usurper Israeli regime has been deeply involved in fomenting chaos in Sudan.
Lest we forget, Sudan was the largest country by area in Africa and the Arab League until the secession of South Sudan in 2011. This secession was backed by the U.S.-led Western powers and the Israeli regime. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov recently called on Sudan's warring parties to remember how the Sudanese state evolved. During a news conference at the United Nations, Lavrov blamed the U.S. for dividing the country into a northern state and a southern state. Let's take a listen.
Let us recall the developments with Sudanese statehood, first in the singular and then Sudan and South Sudan. And this was all transpiring before our very eyes when our U.S. colleagues made one of their foreign policy priorities the division of Sudan into two parts. They turned to us for the then President Omar al-Bashir for us to persuade Mr. Bashir to reach an agreement for the conduct of free elections on voluntary separation and division, and we, frankly speaking, thought that the Sudanese people, the peoples, should make that decision. And ultimately, the division took place. It was separated into two parts. A South Sudan was created, and the Americans, as the initiators of this divorce, so to speak, should have done everything possible to help these new two states coexist, to develop their economies, to provide for the welfare of their citizens, but the Americans didn't like something. I won't delve into the details, but they imposed sanctions both against the leadership of Sudan and against the leadership of South Sudan.
Now, Mr. Hamdi, Western powers and the Israeli regime backed South Sudan during the war that eventually led to the secession of this country. Now, there is concern that continued clashes between the warring sides in Sudan are actually part of a long-term plan by Western powers and the Zionist regime to further balkanize this third largest African country. Do you agree with this viewpoint?
When we're looking at what's happening in Sudan, the Americans have two scenarios. One is that Sudan removes Islam from the constitution, it becomes a secular state, the Islamists are no longer in power, and instead they have these leftist and powers that are ruling Sudan, and they are supported by the international community. If the Sudanese army rejects that, as Burhan is doing at this moment in time, then they will support other separatist movements, whether it's in Darfur or the like, essentially splitting Sudan further. So not just South Sudan, but having Darfur, there might be a rebel movement that appears in the east that used to appear in order to bomb the pipelines or the like. The reality is that the Americans will say either Sudan falls in line with the ideological changes that we want, or we are happy to support the breakup of Sudan, as we're seeing today, given the fighting has spread towards Darfur, and given that the U.S. approach is not to support the army against Hemeti's coup, but to push for a mediation that keeps Hemeti's army or Hemeti's militia outside the control of the state, so that Hemeti can be used later to squeeze the army instead.
The Israeli apartheid regime has offered to play what it claims is a mediator role between the two clashing sides in Sudan. This is while the Sudanese people have expressed their total rejection of any normalization of ties with the Israeli regime.
الوقفة الاحتجاجية دي هي وقفة منددة وقفة رافضة لهذا اللقاء ورافضة للتطبيع مع الكيان الصهيوني بأي مستوى من المستويات ويعني زايد نصرة القضية الفلسطينية بالنسبة لنا هي أولوية طبعا.
Now, Mr. Mbaluto, what is the real reason behind this proposal by the Israeli regime that it wants to mediate between the warring parties in Sudan while the Sudanese people have come out to vehemently oppose ties with the usurper Israeli regime?
No, when you see Israel proposing, I wouldn't rule out that Israel is trying to, or rather U.S., is what we see Israel doing is doing as a proxy of the U.S., No one can rule out that either, because we see most of the time in international setting, we've seen Israel also being a partner or being an ally of the U.S. We have seen that ongoing for a long time. So we cannot rule out that, you know, Israel efforts are not U.S. efforts. But again, how does that look like? You're making that proposal on the ground with other very powerful interests from Russia, from these other Arabic countries, pretty much murky situation. So our hope now probably may rest on Africa unity, may rest on IGAD group of countries, because then those ones are seen as neutral. And when they are seen as neutral, they can actually be the ones to broker peace.
The United Nations Special Representative in Sudan said that both sides have nominated representatives for peace talks. He's also called for a permanent end to the conflict and issued the following warning.
Regional countries and the international community must say that if the situation continues, even if one side wins the fight, that side would not be accepted internationally. If a side refuses negotiations and refuses reconciliation, it will not be accepted internationally, regionally, and I think also nationally in Sudan.
The African Union's Peace and Security Council warned against external interference in the current crisis in Sudan and demanded that the warring parties swiftly embrace a peaceful solution and inclusive dialogue. What's your take on this statement?
It's not really forceful. It doesn't come with the force that I want to see. I think from where I stand, it has come time for Africa Union. Number one, to have stand by force. Military capable stand by force. I know they have AMISOM, but the funding of AMISOM has been a challenge in the past. If it was to be funded by the same countries that keep on trying to control Africa, it just doesn't have the strength that is required. So what I would have loved in ideal situation would be immediately the war kicked off in Sudan between these two generals. I would have loved to see Africa or AMISOM powerful, ready to intervene and intervening in Sudan, militarily building that buffer zone so that the two forces are not able to continue to fight.
There have been several mediation proposals by trans-regional powers aimed at ending the conflict in Sudan. Many in Africa expect the African Union to lead efforts aimed at bringing together the warring parties in Sudan within the framework of African solutions to African problems. However, this continental body is yet to take decisive mediation measures.
I think that one of the things that's very important to note is that from the perspective of the African Union, what they're seeing and what they are concerned about is the emergence of militias outside the control of the state. And one of the reasons the African Union is not keen on mediation between Hemeti and between Burhan is because they believe that this mediation will recognize Hemeti's militia outside the control of the state. And that has deep ramifications for countries such as Somalia, countries such as Eritrea, other countries where we are seeing a buildup of militias being supported internationally that are beginning to operate outside the control of the state. For the African Union, they believe that the Sudanese army must be protected. As an institution, its authority must be protected. And that's why we've seen that Washington prefers to host a mediation in Riyadh or host a mediation with the powers that want to help Hemeti stay outside the control of the state and doesn't want to go with the African Union mediation that insists that Hemeti should hand over power to the Sudanese army. And this is why I think that the African Union has the correct approach to preserve the integrity of the state. But Washington is not interested in that. Washington wants to go for an option that preserves Hemeti's independence outside the army, because for Washington, if Burhan wins, if the Sudanese army win, then they will continue to resist the ideological changes that Washington is trying to impose in Sudan.
United Nations has warned that the humanitarian crisis in the country was turning into a full-blown catastrophe and that the risk of spillover into neighboring countries was worrisome. The UN Secretary General said the violence must stop.
The violence must stop. It risks a catastrophic conflagration within Sudan that could engulf the whole region and beyond. I strongly condemn the indiscriminate bombardment of civilian areas, including healthcare facilities. And I call on the parties to stop combat operations in densely populated areas and to allow unhindered humanitarian aid operations. Civilians must be able to access food, water, and other essential supplies and evacuate from combat zones.
Sudan's former Prime Minister Abdel Hamdok has also warned that the clashes in his country could deteriorate into one of the worst civil wars than those experienced in Syria and Libya if the fighting is not stopped. Speaking in Nairobi recently during a governance forum, Hamdok said that transitions have their own ups and downs.
Transitions, by their nature, they are nonlinear. They never travel in a straight line. They have their ups and downs. It was our unity that toppled the dictatorship. And we should not lose track on that.
Yeah.
We should have been staying the course as a unified front. And I was telling them time and again that to protect the transition, we need to stay unified.
Now, the military conflict in Sudan has derailed a plan for a transition to a civilian government 4 years after the fall of Omar al-Bashir and 2 years after a military coup. Now, briefly, what will be the fate of Sudan in the near future and distant future?
And I think that now what we're seeing is that Burhan is between two choices. Either he joins this mediation process and essentially builds this transition period, which is built on denying the Sudanese to vote, or he wins the fight against Hemeti and uses that as leverage to begin a genuine democratic process because he believes that the U.S. will no longer support him, and therefore to rescue himself, he has to go to elections. It's not that Burhan is democratic. It's not that Burhan likes elections. It's not that Burhan wants to host a democratic transition. It's more that Burhan believes that his survival is more likely in a democratic transition if he's forced to hand over power than it is under a transition period in which they are trying to hand over power to unelected civilian parties. So I think in terms of the fate of Sudan, it depends on whether Burhan wins his fight against Hemeti or goes to mediation and we go back to square one, a transition process that prevents any elections and prevents the Sudanese from choosing their leaders.
Well, the situation in Sudan is still unfolding, and here at Africa Today, we shall keep you posted on what is going on. I'd like to thank our guests today, Sami Hamdi, the International Interest Editor-in-Chief, and Julius Mpaluto, our political analyst, for their incisive analysis. And that wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today. Goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering the doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan?
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Color of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atta, the host of this program. Sheikh Karimi is the guest speaker for today's discussion. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Okay, Sheikh, for today's discussion, we want to talk about the world of Barzakh. There are so many doubts and questions regarding the interval between this world and the hereafter called as Barzakh. What is this world exactly? What is this place exactly? And do we have any Quranic reference or in the Rivayat and Ahadith giving us some details about this type of world?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In Arabic language, the word Barzakh means barrier between two things. And technically, it is referring to the world between this world and the hereafter. From the time that a person passes away, he or she enters the world of Barzakh till the day of judgment that all the people are resurrected. The word Barzakh has been mentioned in the Quran in three occasions, but only one of them is referring to this technical term. In other occasions, they are referring to the literal meaning of the word of Barzakh. Now, so we have one verse in the Noble Book of Quran referring directly to this world. In chapter Mu'minun, verse 99, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم حتى إذا جاء أحدهم الموت قال رب ارجعون. When death comes to one of them, he says, my Lord, take me back. لعلي أعمل صالحا فيما تركت, that I may act righteously in what I have left behind. كلا إنها كلمة هو قائلها. By no means, these are mere words that he says. ومن ورائهم برزخ إلى يوم يبعثون. And before them is a barrier or the world of Barzakh until the day that they will be resurrected. So very explicitly, this verse is talking about the fact that there is an intermediary world between this world that we are living in and the world of Barzakh, and that is what we call it, the world of Barzakh. Some people translate it into purgatory, which is not a good translation because the Christian understanding of purgatory is very much different.
It's a kind of middle world, we can say. Can we say? Kind
yeah, of yeah, but it's not right. Purgatory. Their understanding of purgatory is different.
That's right.
Yeah. So this is one verse in the Noble Book of Quran. When it comes to the narrations, we have many narrations about this world. Sometimes it is called the world of Barzakh or the world of Qabr or grave and so on and so forth. For example, in one narration, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, Wallahi atakhawwafu alaykum fil barzakh, addressing his Shia, says that I'm very much afraid about you, I'm very much concerned about you regarding the world of Barzakh. Or in another narration, the Imam was asked about the world of Barzakh. He said, Al-Qabr mundu hina mawtihi ila yawm al-qiyamah. Barzakh is referring to your grave, I mean the world of the grave, from the time that you pass away till the day of judgment. And there are some other names for this world. For example, it is called Al-Qiyamatu Sughra, the lesser day of judgment, or the minor day of judgment, or the minor resurrection. And that is because of the fact that according to some narrations, at least some people are rewarded in the world of Barzakh and some people are punished based on their actions. And also it is called the world of Mithal. And the reason that it is called Mithal is, this technical term is in answer to the question that are we going to live in the world of Barzakh, in a physical form or in a spiritual form? Mm-hmm. The understanding of the famous answer of the Shia scholars to this question is that something in between, and they call it a mithali body. A mithali body is referring to a body which looks like the physical one, but it's not physical. Somehow we can compare it to what we see in our dreams, but with slight differences. So the point is that when we pass away, our soul, according to, famous understanding, our soul has a body which is not physical, but it looks like the physical body of us in this world.
Okay.
Now, there are some points about the world of Barzakh, for example, when the people are put in the grave or they, pass away. One of the main points of the world of Barzakh in the first stage is what we call it su'al, or the question in the grave. And according to many narrations, both in Shia and Sunni sources, all the people, without exception, are asked about their beliefs and their deeds in this world, in the world of Barzakh, when they are put in the grave. The next point is about reward and punishment in the grave. Now, some verses of the Quran, according to some scholars, they refer to the fact that right from the time that you are put in the grave, you may be rewarded by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, or you may be punished. It has been mentioned in the Noble Book of Quran regarding some believers that peace be upon you. The angels, when they take the soul of some of the believers, they say that they give them glad tidings, that peace be upon you, and now you are going to enter the heaven. We know that it's not the eternal heaven, so according to some scholars, it is referring to that smaller heaven in the grave. And for Pharaoh, for example, we have a verse referring to the fact that right from the time that he passes away, he is punished by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So this is not the day of judgment. So they said that it is referring to his punishment in the world of Barzakh, or in his grave.
IRIB English Radio presents Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Answering your theological questions in Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Send us your questions to EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
But can we say that the world of Barzakh is an outer world where the soul enters, or no? It is the Barzakh of your soul. You are in fact going down to your soul, because when you pass away, the soul is separated from your body. So now, is this soul entering a new world, or no? We can say you are entering your soul, the world of your internal. The Barzakh of your amal is with yourself. Now you can enter it, or no? You are entering a separate world.
The point is that, as I mentioned, we are talking about the Mithali world.
Mm-hmm.
It is different from this world, but it is not the world of the hereafter, okay? Of course, we are not talking about physical world. Spiritually speaking, it is a separate world from this world. But does it mean that, necessarily speaking, physically speaking, it is outside this world? Not necessarily. So the soul joins a Mithali body, which looks like the physical body, but it doesn't have any physical feature.
Okay.
And then they continue to be in this world until the day that all the people are resurrected by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now, there are some discussions about the world of Barzakh. Are all people punished or rewarded by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the grave? According to some scholars, it's not for all the people. The reward is for some people. The punishment is for some people. And some people just pass the world of Barzakh as if they are asleep. But the other viewpoint is that no, the punishment and reward is for all the people. The next point is that sometimes some good people are punished in the world of Barzakh for some of the sins of these people to be forgiven by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, so that on the Day of Judgment they have no remaining sins. Now imagine you are a mu'min, you are a believer, but unfortunately you have committed some sins. So some sins can be forgiven by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala through your difficulties, your problems. For example, you become sick, Allah